Coming up on Boston Public Radio, turns out it doesn't end with those Verizon calls. The National Security Agency also has records on us from all the big internet firms. You worried now? A privacy expert tells us if we should be. Then, would you buy a lobster at Walgreens? Yes, a live lobster right next to the deodorant. How about cheese at a taxidermy shop? Certain things just don't fit in certain places. Or do they? Marjorie?
Emily Rooney joins us with her increasingly famous Emily's List of Outrages. Governor Deval Patrick admits he got quite drunk the night after the police caught Zohar Tsarnaev. Is that okay with you? And then our news quiz with Boston.com photographer Bill Brett and the man behind the Facebook sensation Dirty Old Boston. What's that? Find out coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. You know what day today is?
This is my son's 21st birthday. Thank
is it
you.
Really?
Thank you for remembering that. I
didn't even know he was 21. Actually,
I thought he was 12.
That's no, it's important. But what is even more important, as you know, is National Donut Day.
Oh, of course.
And if you go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Boston Public Radio, you can both see and read our reaction to the whole 6-member BPR team, by the way, to Dunkin' Donuts' latest, which, you know what's in there? You want to describe it?
Yeah, it's a glazed donut cut in half.
Yep.
In the middle, there's bacon, egg, and a little bit of cheese, I believe.
Was there cheese? But all I can say is, So go to our Facebook page and check it out. Now from the ridiculous to the sublime. You know, yesterday at this exact time, we spoke with Harvard Law School's Larry Tribe about news that the National Security Agency was collecting information on every call, every day, from all of us on Verizon Business Services. And we asked if it likely stopped there. Well, we got part of our answer this morning. If you read the Washington Post, the Post reported that government also has access to the servers of the top internet firms in the country, like Yahoo, Google, Facebook, and more.
Well, you know what, Jim? It's kind of a weird split because some liberal legislators, like Democrat Dianne Feinstein, Senator, of course, from California, she supports it, while conservatives like Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, and he's one of the authors of the Patriot Act.
Is,
he's from
yeah.
Wisconsin. He says, and here's his quote, "Seizing phone records of millions of innocent people is excessive and un-American."
But the question neither Tribe nor we could answer yesterday was, what does and what can the government do with all that information? We're joined now by somebody who can answer the question. James Bamford is a journalist who specializes in U.S. intelligence agencies. He's written many books. Amongst them is The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to The Eavesdropping on America. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure, Jim.
James, we were talking about this yesterday with a lot of our listeners who thought that, well, you know, it's post 9/11 world. If you're not doing anything wrong, what do you have to worry about? So, what do you have to worry about, James?
Well, there's a lot of things. If the government has access to everybody's phone records, is that the kind of country we want to live in? That's what they did in East Germany at the time, and they did a lot of bad things to people there who were able to collect all their records. And it's not just phone calls; it's email and tweets and Facebook pages. Now they have access to. So there's a question of why do they need all this access? Since they're looking for so few terrorists, and one of the problems is when you build the haystack too high. With all this data, it makes it even harder to try to find the needle in that haystack. So in terms of what they do with it, they mine it for information. They do data mining. They look for connections. If you called somebody who was the babysitter of somebody who was a target, you may become a target yourself because they draw these concentric lines around the targets. So it's not just the target that's focused. They don't know whether you're the babysitter or they don't know if babysitter is just a cover for something else. So you become a suspect. And these concentric circles around the target make the suspects part of the target.
Well, you know, you just mentioned the haystack and you've written about the haystack needle kind of deal where your argument is, and I think this is a very troubling one too, is that we do have all this information. The haystack is getting ever, ever bigger, but we don't find those needles. And, you know, we have missed a lot, most recently the marathon bombing. So that's my concern, is that we don't really know how to find the needles very well.
Well, right. We spend so much time hiring people to use pitchforks to put more data on the pile, and not enough money or time or effort to find people that are more expert at finding the needles, analysts and so forth. So they spend more time, every time there's a terrorist incident, they say, well, we need more information. And, well, they've had all this information now for 7 years, and they missed the Boston Marathon bombing. They missed the underwear bomber. They missed the Times Square bomber. And, you know, you ask them, well, what have you found? They said, well, we think we did find one terrorist, but we can't tell you anything about that.
That's what the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Rogers, said. We found one situation. But to get away from the farm imagery for a second and get back to the marathon comparison, we talked to a lot of people, James, who said, well, listen, you know, you got to understand there were 700,000 people, I may be off by a few, on that watch list that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was on. So you can't expect them to mine all that. Well, if they can't do that, assuming that story is true, how can they ever do what you say they do, which is scary to me, if we're talking about 350 million people? How do they have that capacity?
Well, that's the problem. In terms of capacity, they've got computers that can sift through all this. They've got a computer now they're working on in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that will be the fastest and most powerful computer on Earth. So they have the speed to run through these numbers, but they don't have the analysts, the human beings, that can make sense of what all that means. That's the problem.
So why do they want it then? So why do they, if they can't analyze it and they know it upsets at least some portion of the American public, I don't think it upsets enough of us, why do they want it then?
Well, you know, I've been writing about intelligence for 30 years now, done numerous books and all kinds of articles and TV shows and so forth. And one thing that's always a common denominator whenever I get together with intelligence people is they always want more information. I mean, no matter how much they have, they always want more, and that's the way NSA has always been. If you give them access to A, they want access to A, B, and C. It's just the nature of their profession, I guess. But the problem is that they don't understand that surplus information equals lost information. You don't get the information that you're looking for, and I don't think it'll ever change. And the other problem is that all this is very secret. So this expansion of access is all secret. Nobody's allowed to know that they're expanding into the telecom Verizon, for example, or Google and so forth. In England, I just came back from London from 10 days a couple of days ago, and they're basically having the same debate, except it's open. There's a bill in Congress, or bill in Parliament, rather, to give the government access to Internet service providers, all the records in there. And it's been debated in Parliament, and it's been debated in the press. It was turned down the first time, and it looks like it's going to be turned down again this time. But at least it's an open process, and they're talking about it in public, and the public has a right to understand what's being suggested and have a voice in it. Over here, there is no voice. It's this sort of dictatorial society where the intelligence community makes all these decisions behind the scenes, and you know, they're just ratified by themselves.
But, you know, that does strike me as odd. Have we always been this way, or is this a post, you know, McCarthy kind of a communism hunting kind of thing, or is this a 9/11 thing? What's the history here?
Well, it is. It's all this post 9/11 hysteria over terrorism.
Okay.
And I did several books on NSA before 9/11, and I interviewed the director of NSA just before 9/11, and he was. His main concern was keeping NSA away from the American public. I mean, he was doing everything he could to make sure that NSA had no presence in the United States in terms of eavesdropping. And all that completely shifted after 9/11. It's all this focus on America. The NSA was never created to focus on the United States. It was created just like the Army or the Marines or the Air Force to focus on foreign enemies,
right.
foreign conflicts. And it was never intended to be turned on the American public, just so, like we don't have Marines patrolling the streets.
You know, James Bamford, when you mentioned this secretive nature of this thing, not only do we not know what they're seeking, nor do we know what they have access to, nor can the entity from which they have gotten the information, like a Verizon or like a Google, even tell its customers that they've passed along the information. One of the most stunning and chilling statistics I read in the Globe story today was that there have been 1,789 requests for surveillance, apparently, to the NSA. I'm not sure what the time frame is. I should have noted that. And of the 1,789, one was withdrawn by the government, and the other 1,788 were approved by this FISA court, which basically means, you're going to laugh and say this is obvious. It wasn't so obvious to me. This is a 100% rubber stamp. Whatever the government wants, the government gets.
Yeah, it's actually not 100%. I actually talked about FISA years ago before any of this, before anybody ever heard about it, and lawyers thought I was kidding when I said there was a secret court nobody's ever heard of, where it's, even its location is secret. But there, believe it or not, there is a there was one case where they did turn down the government, and the government has a right to appeal to a higher court. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Appeals. And it's only heard one case in its history. It's sort of the Maytag repairman of the judiciary. they only heard one case. And if they turned down the government, which they didn't in this one case, but if they turned down the government has a right for an immediate in-camera appeal, in other words, secret appeal, to the U.S. Supreme Court. So the odds of ever the government not getting a, what they call an order from the FISA court is almost impossible.
If we're talking with James Bamford, who's written extensively on security issues, the National Security Agency, written four books on them. James, the one thing I don't understand, I mean, you've mentioned this, and the more I read about this, the more it becomes apparent that we have these mountains or haystacks, whatever you want to call them, of information, but a lot of difficulty, you know, finding the terrorists within that mountain or haystack. These people can't be a bunch of idiots. I mean, they must realize that all this information is overwhelming them, and they are missing a lot of this stuff. So why not the emphasis on hiring more of those analysts and human capital to find those suspicious people like the Sarnaevs and hopefully head them off at the pass kind of deal?
Well, it's funny. You know, when they when these intelligence officials go before Congress and I've talked to many of these people after they've given presentations before the Senate and the House Intelligence Committee. And when they go in there, what these congressmen and senators are always looking for is some spectacular new technical development, like going in there and say, we have this new satellite and it will pick up 18 trillion phone calls all at the same time or something like that. And that's where they get all the money, is by coming up with all these new technologies when they go in there. If they go in there and they say, we need 100 new analysts, they never get the money for it because they say, you got enough people there, you know, you got enough people. But if you go in there and you wow them with some new computer or technology or satellite, they're much more likely to give you money. So, I mean, that's
wow.
bizarre, but that is how it works a lot of times.
Hey, James Bamford, thanks so much for your time and your information. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate being on your show. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Very depressing.
You think so?
Our numbers are 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. We want to ask you guys what you think about this. I mean, it's ever more frightening.
I want to hear specifically, well, anybody can call, but explicitly, Marjorie, I want to hear from those people who yesterday called us, which was the majority of callers, who expressed no concern, even support for this. Now they've heard James Bamford, and they've heard the fact that the program is far bigger than was first reported, all this access to Internet server information. We want to know if you're still okay with this at 877-301-8970. And the fact that every single request that has ever been made by the government, every single request has been approved, and James Bamford corrected me and said with one exception, and then it was appealed, the denial was appealed to another secret court, and the secret court approved it. I'd like to know what those judges do when they're not deciding that one case. That's a job I'd like.
And as you said before, it's all these internet servers now, Yahoo, Google, all that, Facebook is in there, Skype's in there. And then, you know, your audio and video chats and your photographs and your emails and your documents. So it is pretty scary. But what's really scary to me is that we have all this information and we're blowing it. Because go back to the Tsarnaevs, the whole question about, you know, what we should have known when the Russians were tipping us off. Now it's become controversial because Bill Keating, one congressman, says that, you know, we could have prevented the bombings had we acted on the Russian intelligence.
Except other we haven't people, heard from him since
we
he
haven't,
made that
and other people say that's not true. So maybe Keating was wrong to say that. But the point is, we have, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, with the whole Nova series about these massive buildings amassing all this information. And Bamford had in one of his pieces this whole thing about this $2 billion NSA building out in Salt Lake City.
Right outside Salt Lake City,
they
Utah,
had a secret ribbon-cutting ceremony for this $2 billion new building last week. We didn't even know about it. Did you have any idea we were spending this money on that?
I did, but I just read about it in the last few days. But one other thing that Bamford just said to us, which I thought was most significant to me, even for those of you who are perfectly fine with this, his comparison with Great Britain, where they're doing a comparable kind of thing, but they're having the debate openly. I think Greenwald was quoted on National Public Radio right before we came on earlier this morning, saying, what possible harm, and this is what we're hearing from the Obama administration and the intelligence people, what harm is there for the to security interests for the American people to know what's being collected on them?
Their argument is that the people, that the terrorists will find alternative ways, that they will stop doing things online, that they will stop.
Excuse me, if you're collecting every phone call, every internet, everything, your texts, your tweets, your Facebook postings, Skype, what else is there? They're essentially, I think the default position is every piece of information they can possibly collect,
they will do what Whitey Bulger did. They'll get out of their cars and walk around beaches and have conversations with each other with the waves in the background so no one will know what they're plotting.
Let's take a couple of calls here. Jeff, you're in Hyannis. You're on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, thanks for the call. Hi.
Hi. Great show, both of you. Great topic.
Thank you.
I personally have no personal issue with this, but I think it's important to keep in mind, such as the Boston bombers, we know the misses, but we don't hear about the hits. And they're not going to disclose the hits because that could divulge how they're finding them.
Well, maybe. No, we know about the alleged the hits. This guy, Mike Rogers, who's the Republican House chair of the Intelligence Committee, who was totally on the side of the collection of this data, said that we discovered and dealt with one major terror threat. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not true. But, Jeff, what I said to some of our colleagues upstairs, if you're not troubled by this because you're doing nothing wrong, how would you feel if the government said, we can do even a better job of preventing terrorism if we put cameras in your houses? And why is that any different than this? And if it turns out you're doing nothing wrong,
it's different.
Why is it different than collecting all our phone and internet information?
And it's different.
Exactly.
I mean, you're walking around your underwear in your house.
Excuse me. Other than saying it, would you mind having a camera in your house, Jeff?
Well, that's a little bit of hyperbole, sir.
I don't think it is at all.
The Supreme Court outlawed the use of infrared cameras. But I'll just close with one.
Well, excuse me, if I may. I would argue that what the Supreme Court has ruled to violate the Fourth Amendment may not apply to the powers of the government under the Patriot Act. So I don't know, but I assume it's very possible that would pass muster. But go ahead, Jeff. I'm sorry.
I would agree, but just one funny anecdote from a reputable source, which was U.S. News and World Report. The NSA actually built, I think it was a 10-story building in the environs. It was inside the Beltway. This was about 2 decades ago. It was black by any chance. But what was hilarious about it is they would not even admit who was building the building until a source told a reporter. I always thought that was very cute.
It's like a stealth building. Jeff, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970 is our number.
If it is a point worth repeating.
What's that?
What Bamford said about the in Great Britain, they're having this open debate and we're having this secret.
Right. They're not concerned about security there. They have as much reason, if not more than
more.
We well, at least as much as
I mean,
we do.
Remember the attacks on the double-decker busters, the terrorist
attacks
on the double-decker
buses? Well, I also remember what happened a week or two ago to that military person.
Let's go to Jim from Winthrop. Thank you for calling, Jim. What do you think? Is this okay with you, this heightened surveillance, or not?
Absolutely not. This has become a secret service place. It's like feeling like I'm in pre-war Germany saying, should we pack the bags and go, or should we let the Nazis just take care of our lives for us? It's fascism.
Well, I don't know if I don't know if I feel like it's East Germany yet. I mean, it's.
But it is. I mean,
no,
but there is
Germany, the pre-war Germany. When you're thinking,
you mean the Hitler Germany?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Jim, how do you react when you hear? I would say the vast majority of callers we've had and emailers in the last 2 days that we've been discussing this are where the prior caller was, saying, "Listen, I'm fine. If they're keeping me safe,
I'm
perfectly
totally against that."
Yeah, but there is that. The point I'm trying to make is there is a post 9/11 mentality where it appears to me, I haven't seen recent polls, where at least a growing number of people, if not a majority, and I bet it is a majority, say if this is what government says is necessary to protect us, so be it.
Cheap.
Jim, thank you.
We
for
know
the
what
call.
Else is wrong with this argument. I think it's ridiculous of us to think that they can keep us safe. I don't know how.
Then don't collect the data. Then,
well, I mean, that's a debate we should have as well, isn't it? I mean, how much can you? I've always thought this about crime as well, or about murderers, or about even violations of restraining orders. When you have criminals that are reasonably intelligent and hell-bent on doing a certain thing, it is very difficult to prevent them. You can prevent the sloppy people, the people that are sort of open about it and open their mouths and blab about it and stuff like that. But I'm not sure, tragically, that we can prevent a lot
of stuff.
Well,
what if it's the other side, Marjorie? Just conjecture for a second. Let's assume they do have greater capacity to mine this stuff. We're talking hundreds of millions of records on Americans, this Verizon internet thing. Mm-hmm. 700,000 people on the watch list. What if it turns out the whole storyline since the marathon is wrong? And then, in fact, the authorities were following the Tsarnaevs, did know about Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and they just blew it. I mean,
I think it's incompetence.
No, I'm suggesting they may very well have followed up on the 2011 interviews. They may have been following, I don't know this to be true, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and they just may have blown it on the date of April 15th. I mean, if they can't monitor a list with 700,000 people, how can anyone in their right mind suggest they can mine and scrutinize a list with 350 million people?
Yeah, I think if they were as suspicious of the Tsarnaev brothers as that, then with all those police officers and law enforcement people at the finish line of the Boston Marathon with bomb-sniffing dogs and everything else, they would have seen them coming down the street and done something about it.
Sean, you're in Dedham. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Excellent. I think, at least until we hear from what you have to say. We will judge that in a minute, Sean.
Jim, why don't you go take a walk then? Have a cigarette. Marjorie.
Yes.
Didn't Barack speak about transparency?
He's not very transparent, Sean.
Yeah, where's the outrage? If this was George Bush, the Dems would be calling from screaming from the floor. They'd be rabid right now. They'd be foaming at the mouth. But it's their guy. It's their messiah. So they're going to keep quiet about
it. Sean, let me just say, believe it or not, I totally agree with you for once. But the one thing that may make you feel better,
finally getting smart, Jimmy,
as a local guy, virtually every Democratic member of the delegation, which is the whole delegation in Massachusetts, virtually all of them have voiced severe concerns in the last 24 hours about this. So I think that, and most of them are liberal Democrats, Sean, who I know are not generally.
All this technology they have, why don't they use their technology? You're going to love this, Jimmy, right up your alley here. Yeah. Why don't they use the snag EBT abusers? I find out about these people who have $4 million in the bank of our money, and why aren't they spending it?
Sean.
Unbelievable.
Sean, thanks. Guys, great to talk to you.
There was a very interesting bit of information in the Globe story today. It was talking about this Foreign Intelligence Service Court and how surveillance court,
yeah,
and how they need to be reauthorized all the time to go after these mm-hmm. records. And there was a vote in December 2012. Scott Brown and John Kerry voted in favor of allowing them to continue collecting these records.
And Lynch did too, right?
And
I think Lynch was
the only one among our House congressional delegation.
Yeah.
Everybody else voted against it. So the liberals in that case, and they all are very liberal Democrats, voted against the reauthorization. John Kerry is a liberal Democrat. He voted for it.
Maybe a new head of job coming in the future. Let's take one more here. Let's go to Jay and Lowell. You're next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the latest on the National Security Agency's surveillance of Americans. Hey, Jay.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I'm Marjorie.
Hey.
Hey, I just quickly, I never listened to you in your old station, but I listen to you every day here.
We love that, Jay.
Thank you.
It's
a pleasure.
Thanks.
Listen, I'm really surprised that nobody's kind of talked about the whole right of association. If forget about walking around in my underwear or knowing exactly what is contained in my conversation, I no longer have the right of free association. I can't call who I want, when I want, meet them on a corner. GPS records on a phone are just as available as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everybody's got a cell phone. Why is it, you know... Go ahead.
No, I agree with you completely, but the response we've heard regularly, Jay, I am totally where you are, is, I mean, it's a tired line already. I haven't done anything wrong, so if people want to follow me around, if people want to surveil me, I am perfectly fine with it. I find that to be almost un-American, a word I almost never use, but freedom is sort of the cornerstone of our existence here, and it seems to me this is such an impingement and beyond on freedom that I find it hard to believe. But, Jay, thank you for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay, we're going to move on from this because we're going to talk to Callie Crossley coming up next about a couple of things. One of them is earlier this week, Michelle Obama was heckled at a fundraising event. Should she have handled the civil disobedience with more civility? We'll debate that and other things with Callie Crossley. Join us for that conversation next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
Says the NSA needs to collect citizens' phone records to protect the country from terrorist threats. But is it in our best interests, or is it just Big Brother? We'll call up the barbershop guys and see what they have to say next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org. And Fruitlands Museum, 4 historic exhibition buildings and over 200 acres of meadows and trails. Now through June, presenting Visions, Tim Hetherington, a photojournalism exhibit. More at Fruitlands.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. I'm sure you remember about a week ago, the president was giving a speech at the National Defense University and was being heckled about Guantanamo by a code pinker. Here's how he handled it.
So today, once again, today, I'm about to address it, ma'am, but you got to let me speak. I'm about to address it.
And he goes on to say that I have a right to speak. You're going to please listen to me speak. And ultimately, the code pinker quieted down. More recently than that, Michelle Obama was at a fundraiser in Washington. She was heckled, interrupted by a gay rights activist. This is going to be relatively hard to hear. You'll hear it, and then Marjorie will tell you exactly what she said.
And I don't care what you believe in. We don't. Wait. One of the things that I don't do well is this.
I can take the mic,
but I'm leaving. So you all decide.
No, I'm sure.
No.
I need your husband.
You have one choice.
No.
All right, you guys.
No.
No, please don't leave.
Actually, I was wrong. The sound was absolutely perfect. Here with us to discuss, I guess, the art of dealing with a heckler, particularly in the case of Michelle Obama, is the host of Under the Radar. You can hear it every single Sunday night at 6:30. That'd be Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie.
Hello, Jim. Hello, hey. Marjorie.
Hello, Callie Crossley. So what'd you think of Michelle?
I thought she did exactly what I've seen so many, certainly black women, do in a similar situation. I think there are 3 issues that came together here. First, she's Michelle Obama. She's the first lady. So people were interested in any case of what she's going to say. Secondly, which I actually didn't get until the second hearing, because the first time I heard it, nobody identified the heckler as a gay activist. So I didn't know there was a black versus gay thing going on till way later in it. I was just taken with her response, which I thought was you know, she did it well. She was firm, and she said, I'll leave. If you want me to leave, you can have the mic. That's that. And the third thing is that she's always, because whatever she says, and particularly if she says it in a firm way, it's now we're back to the angry black woman. There she is, the angry black woman in the front, you know, yelling at people and saying stuff. So there's a lot going on in here, but overarching all of this is the ultimate lack of respect that many, many people feel, but particularly in the African-American community, that the Obamas have experienced. That, you know, as folks will say to you, disagree with them all you want. Don't like them all you want. But the respect for the office and who they are should be there. And it hasn't been in so many instances. And it's been flagrant in so many instances. And people are just shocked and angry. So in the black blogosphere, the answer was finally, yes, you spoke back. You said what should be said. Don't let them disrespect you.
Well, let me tell you, I am a huge fan of Michelle Obama. I don't think I agreed with one word that just came past your lips. One, I don't think it was black versus gay.
A lot of people don't think that.
Well, it's fine. I'm one of those people. Yeah. I think it was the first lady against the gay activist. George Bush was not black, was heckled virtually every place he went where they allowed people. And that's number one. Number two, I have to say at a gathering where people are paying a lot of dough, that because one people is screaming, okay, you can have the mic, I'm going to leave, I thought was actually almost childish, frankly. The reality is, there are one of two choices. Either you can say, listen, say whatever you want when you're done, I'll continue. Or you can do what her husband does, which, and he very strongly said to that heckler the other day about Guantanamo and other hecklers, which basically, what's that?
She interrupted him three times.
Repeatedly.
I remember hearing that.
I don't hear Marjorie's mic, by the way. I was
just going to say that the Code Pink founder interrupted President Obama three times. And by the third time, I wanted to leap up and strangle the Code Pink woman. I mean, she was so obnoxious over and over and over again. And I think because he's more used to it, frankly.
Well, first of all, he has to be used to it. But first, let me begin by this. You are wrong. So,
she's talking to me, by the way.
You tell him, Kelly.
President Obama, that's his gig. You know, people are supposed to yell at you because you set the policy. Michelle Obama does not set policy. Now, she's with the guy who does, admittedly, but she doesn't set policy. That was inappropriate.
What, for the person to heckle at all?
No, to expect that she's going to get something out of her because she's not setting policy. Mm-hmm. Let me put on the table, just put over here to the side one second, that Ellen Stutz, who's the person who yelled out at the Michelle Obama event, has the right to be mad about her situation and to try to get President Obama's ear. 75% of the people identifying themselves as lesbian, gay, transgender voted for President Obama. He's the policymaker. He promised in 2008, I'm going to sign this executive order. He hasn't signed it. She's frustrated. She wants to get to him. Mm-hmm. Hey, got no problem with her. Get to him. Yell at him all you want. Michelle Obama, different territory. Okay, so that's the first thing, because she doesn't set policy. And I was interested in what my black and gay friends and colleagues had to say. And LZ Granderson, who is somebody I admire, ESPN magazine.
Yeah, he said something different.
No, he didn't. He said she had no right to heckle her. Yeah. But she has the right to make her position known, given the support, the full support that a lot of gay and lesbian people have made. So that was his position. I would only say take a little step different from him, because he's a guy, and this is a female thing happening here as well. So Ellen Stutz's other comments that have not been as much out in the public is that she said, I was taken aback and she put her big hand on me. I'm sorry. That comes across to a lot of black people as seriously racially coded and very much privileged.
I hadn't even heard that line. My bottom line, and I will not say to you what you said to me, Kelly, that you're wrong.
You're wrong.
I will say that I think if Michelle Obama was a white woman, the exact same thing. Well, yeah, I hear you.
No.
The exact same thing would happen. Number two, let me just say, to suggest that a first lady is not involved in making policy in 2013.
I didn't suggest she doesn't set policy.
She speaks about it all the time. By the way, part of that speech, if you listen to that speech, which I heard on CNN, she was talking about the policy decisions of her husband. And if you believe in these and want to continue them, it's critical we raise enough money for the midterm election so there are enough people there to support.
I didn't say she doesn't influence
But it was a policy speech. It was a speech about it. The politics have got to be in place with you people, or the policy of my husband's administration is not going to continue.
I did not say she does not influencing. By the way, let's to be clear, the people in the room wanted Ellen Stutz taken out. You know, they supported Michelle Obama.
But that's always the case.
No, that's not always the case. No, that's not always the case.
I have never, ever heard a heckler in a room with a leader of this country. Which one?
Wait a minute. Let's not forget Congressman Wiener when he got up to announce
that's a little different.
He was resigning from Congress. Remember what the heckler said in that case? Bye-bye, pervert. And then he asked him about
the
size.
Can we hear this? We
actually
have it here. Here's a little bit of that Wiener announced. This is when he was still not telling the truth about what had happened or what he'd done. Here it is.
So today I'm announcing my resignation from Congress.
Yeah! Bye-bye, pervert!
Okay. So my colleagues can get back to work. My neighbors can choose a new representative. And most importantly, that my wife and I can continue to heal from the damage I have caused.
That's a, let's say, but there's another moment. I mean, Anthony Weiner, I'm sure, not sure qualifies for a comparison, even though
no,
it's great.
He does not.
But I'll tell you somebody who does. The most popular Republican in America right now is the president's good buddy, the governor of New Jersey. He has a history of taking on people big time when he is heckled. He was in California campaigning for Meg Whitman. Listen to this for a second.
You want to yell at me. But don't give her a hard time. We're here. We're here talking about the future of the state of California and the future of our country. And you know what? And you know what? And you know what? Let me tell you. And let me tell you this. It's people who raise their voices and yell and scream like you that are dividing this country. We're here to bring this country together, not to divide it.
That actually wasn't Christina's worst. I've heard him say shut up to people, including
to a teacher.
A teacher, right? He told a teacher to shut up
I
in New Jersey.
I just have to say, these are all excellent examples of heckling. It is not the same scenario when the woman is a black woman first lady. Here is something that articulates exactly what's being discussed in the blogosphere. This is the title of the post. White lady heckles Michelle Obama. What happens next is something black women know all too well. This is a lack of respect. This is what we are talking about. And that's what she responded to. It didn't have anything to do with the policy
issues
of it.
Wait, she was responding to lack of respect because she's a black woman?
That's exactly right.
Well, I'm sorry.
This is the context of what's happening and why people are so angry about it and why a lot of people in the black blogosphere are happy that she finally said something because they feel as though, and then you just played President Obama's very sort of calm response, that always they're called upon to just take a lot of stuff that other people would not. So, yes, Chris Christie can say what he wants to say. There is no issue around privilege in that discussion or race. It becomes an entirely different scenario when you're talking about a black woman in that position.
So let me ask one last
question. I'm telling you, she's been disrespected over and over again.
So let me ask a question. You know, so anybody who heckles Michelle Obama for the next 2 years is heckling her because she's a black woman? Is that what you're saying?
It depends on the scenario. And the scenario
Give me one where they're not doing
it. I just gave you this. We're just looking at one right here. And then I think about Joe Wilson screaming at President Obama during a speech.
Awful.
Who else had done that? You lie.
Never.
Nobody had done that. Come on. We have to at some point realize that there are some things that happen that have racial overtones. I'm not trying
to
make
Kelly,
it happen.
With all due respect, you know, the implication is that I don't understand that some things have racial
overtones. No, I'm saying,
I am saying that this, in my opinion, does not have a racial overtone.
I think if someone says, I'm taken aback, and she put her big black hand on me,
I'm sorry. She said big black hand?
She said she put her big hands on me.
Well, you just said big black hand.
Yes.
That's a little bit different.
No, I think big hands is...
Okay.
Pretty, we discuss all the time about what is racially coded language. And I think you have to look at it and where you are in terms of the context.
Again, I hadn't heard the hand comment before you mentioned
it.
Well,
that's why I'm here to bring up all the stuff.
I hear you.
So I'm just saying that it just, you know, this is the kind of thing that really distresses people unnecessarily. That does not, and I want to be clear, Ellen has a right, this is the activist, to say
to
what
protest.
She would. Yes, absolutely. And in fact, if she had been in the position where the other person was yelling at President Obama, I think there'd be a different response to it. Because he's the guy, you know, he's the man. And I have to look at people who sit in both territories, both black and gay, and I take a page from L.Z. Granderson saying, look, this was off. This was inappropriate. And her response was... People are surprised about it because I think she just had it. I'm just not taking it anymore. Here's what I'm saying. And you do what you want. And she said to the crowd, I'll leave if you want her to speak. And if you want her to speak, that's fine.
Yeah, but I mean,
she was not mean. She was just very firm.
But with the exception of Anthony Weiner, if I just can, every major politician or politician light person like Michelle Obama who's ever been heckled has been heckled by somebody in a crowd which is totally supportive of the person in the front of the room. Is that not a safe assumption?
Let me just quote this from, you know, in this scenario, which is maybe this will help people. This is the writer and creator of This Week in Blackness, and she writes something called The Angry Black Lady Chronicles because this stuff comes up all the time. And she says, anytime black women speak up, not even just to defend themselves, defend ourselves, but just to say anything, all of a sudden it's, why are you so angry? What's so mean about you? What's good? You know, and that's how it's being interpreted when all she was trying to do was say, hey, don't put me in this position. And
I hear you. I thought she was angry. It never entered my mind for a second.
That's the stereotype.
To think she's
that's
an angry black
that's
woman.
That's what's all on the, believe me, that's the discussion on the, on
I hear
everywhere.
You. I hear you.
That's where it's going. And she resented it, and I don't blame her for standing up for it.
So what do you get going on the under the radar? This is a great story. Tell us about this whole liquor license controversy, because I think this is a very big deal.
It is
in,
a big deal. And
Boston.
You know, you've been covering liquor license
yes.
stories forever,
yes.
right? And in Boston is a real, it's so weird here with this whole liquor license thing, and where the power of who gets liquor licenses is you know in the hands of very few. So city councilors Ayanna Pressley and Tito Jackson. Ayanna Pressley is an at-large councilor. Tito Jackson is from Roxbury, so this is a district he represents, are asking once again for more liquor licenses in Dudley Square. Why? Because as you know, they should have had them there anyway. But right now, there's a great renovation going of the Ferdinand building, some other things. Restaurants want to come in there, but they don't make any money if they can't have a liquor license. And it's been something that's been going on for a long time
years.
In terms of...
This is Diane Wilkinson
exactly.
years ago got
exactly.
in trouble over this. She was trying to help yeah. get liquor licenses in Dudley Square. What was that, 5 years ago?
Right. That's why she went to jail, because
she took
a bribe for trying to help somebody, you know, navigate through the liquor yeah. license process.
Had she not stuffed the cash in her bra, she would have been okay.
Well,
but that was the
photo
loss.
For the ages.
But
yes.
I think that represents how large this issue is, and I guess it's a big deal anyway for other areas of town because of this sort of concentration of just a few folk. But Dudley Square could particularly use it. So that's the discussion, and it has to do with exactly what you said, Marjorie, looking at the history of this, the lengths that people have gone to sort of bring more liquor licenses to this area, and to talk about the economic viability that is brought to an area if you are able to have a liquor license.
So Tom Menino runs everything in Boston still, even though he's recovering from his surgery. Yeah. Why are there no liquor licenses still in Dudley Square when all down the waterfront, down by the new Legal Seafoods, down by the new Mexican restaurants down there, down by where the Herald is? I mean, my God, how many liquor licenses have we granted there in just the last couple of years?
Well, I just recall this was a story that the Globe did about 100 years ago, and this was maybe in the same time that the thing was happening with Diane Wilkerson, talking about one law firm that had the grip on all of the clients that got liquor licenses, and the rest of them sort of,
that's right.
you know, if you didn't,
did you,
if you weren't a client, you didn't get them.
Did you just say this is sort of like the cab thing we were talking about with Brian McGorry yeah. in the Globe. There are a limited number of these
liquor
things,
licenses.
Which
right.
means the value goes up dramatically,
right.
which means the people who control the medallions with the cabs yeah. and the liquor licenses here. It's, I mean, it's so ripe for corruption. I'm not even talking about the Wilkerson. It is unbelievable.
You know, now that we've brought up John Wilkerson and the cash and the bra, though, there's a great story about, remember a reporter that used to work at the Herald, his name was Michelle, who wrote about she was going over Diane Wilkerson's expenses, and she came across the $65 for a brassiere. And she thought, why is she putting a $65
really?
Brassiere
this.
On her campaign expenses? Well,
let me finish the story if I can.
I never heard
Marjorie
that
and I did an hour on the radio, on our old Radio Life, talking about the outrage of Diane Wilkerson spending $65 from her campaign account for a brassiere.
I never heard
a
this.
Whole hour. Well, wait a second. Yeah. The show is over. We get off the air. My cell phone rings. And the caller says, hi, Jim. I said, yeah. She said, this is Diane Wilkerson. I said, oops, hi, Senator, how are you? And I start to say something, fumbling. And she says, by the way, you might be interested. If you looked at that report at the Office of Campaign and Political Finance, it wasn't a brassiere for $65. It was a lunch at Brasserie Joe's.
Oh, my God. How embarrassing.
Oh, it was terrible. We had to apologize and
I
correct
guess
ourselves.
So.
But it was a report in the newspaper. We didn't make this up out of whole cloth, did we?
Oh, that is really embarrassing.
You think so? Thank you, Kelly.
Okay.
I think it's a little embarrassing myself.
Because I was thinking I never heard this before.
You missed us that day.
One of our legendary bloopers. Okay, Kelly Crossley is the host of Under the Radar. Radar. It is a great show. She's on every Sunday night at 6:30. This liquor license thing is really annoying. So be sure to tune in 6:30 Sunday night to hear Callie talking about that. Callie, thanks for being here.
Okay. Thanks, Callie.
Everybody loves the convenience of the big box store where you can buy everything you need. But do you want to buy your Bengay, your dental floss, and odor eaters at the same place you buy live lobsters? The pros and cons of shopping is next to one. One-stop shopping is next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm Ibi Caputo. I live here and I report here. I found out where the Boston bombers lived was on my own street.
The normalcy was stunning, given that the street had been cordoned off to residents.
When I was reporting for WGBH Radio from my own block, it really brought home the synergy between living in a community and working in that same community.
FBI, police, and SWAT teams did their
Ibi work. Ibi Caputo, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Northeastern University, where researchers are creating sophisticated computer programs to put the world's cyber criminals out of business. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Before Midnight, starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as Jesse and Celine, a couple vacationing in Greece who continue exploring their relationship after their romantic meeting 18 years ago, starts today.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I would be Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Now, if you venture into the Walgreens in Downtown Crossing, you can buy typical drugstore things. You know, you can buy Band-Aids, deodorant, those shoe inserts that make your feet smell better. But now, what can you also buy there, Marjorie?
Live lobsters.
That's right, which got us to thinking, are you okay buying a live, let's say, pound and a halfer next to a display of foot powder? The price is good, by the way. It's $9.99 per crustacean. It's not $9.99 a pound.
Yeah, they don't do it. So you don't know if you're getting like a little tiny lobster. I think it's against the law to have them under a pound, isn't it?
Those are called chicks. You can't get them under
pound
certainly
a quarter. Maybe you get one with one claw.
Whatever, Marjorie. So the price
is better maybe if I got one claw next to my Dr. Scholl's odor eaters. I don't know, Jim.
Price is good. It's convenient. I think that place is open 24/7, but does it work? We want to know, are there some combinations of products or services which just don't work? For example, Abby, our colleague here, we all know that a lot of people go to IKEA to have the Swedish meatballs, not to buy furniture, that sort of thing. What Abby found is in Hudson, Wisconsin, you can apparently find the best taxidermy shop in that state. And it is a cheese shop as well. So you got a stuffed animal, a cheese shop. Listen to this. DeHart's Bible and Tires in Kentucky. It sells two items. It sells Bibles and tires. So we want to know, are there some combinations that just don't work? So we want to know also, what are the weirdest co-placements of things you've encountered? And were you okay with it? And specifically, I guess, would you buy a lobster at a Walgreens? I love lobster, number one. The price is fabulous, $9.99 for the whole lobster, which probably means it's going to be like $7 a pound, which is a very good deal. I have to say, I really can't imagine going into the Walgreens, walking past the deodorant, past the Metamucil or whatever it is, and then all of a sudden, excuse me, where are the lobsters?
Metamucil.
I mean, can you imagine having the kid who works there reach into the tank to get you? It doesn't work for me,
I guess,
what I'm saying.
Lobster's sort of a treat. I mean, you don't obviously eat it every day because it's not cheap, although $9.99 is pretty cheap.
For the whole lobster,
it's
a very good deal.
Yeah, it is very cheap. But you sort of feel like it's like the experience. You walk into a fish market, and, you know, there's the Clams Casino, and there's the shrimp, and then there's the lobster tank. It makes it more special. I don't know if I'd feel the same way about eating my lobster if I knew it came from Walgreens.
Excuse me, sir. Where is the lobster? Mr. Brody? It's right next to the deodorant in the back of the store. 877-301-8970, or BPR, that's short for Boston Public Radio, WGBH.org. You ever encountered this sort of thing? You know what, a common example?
Would you tell your guests? That's the other thing.
What, did you got out of Walgreens?
If you have people over for dinner, because a couple of times in the summer I have a big lobster dinner, and it's very excited. Yeah, and everybody get clams, and you get corn on the cob, and you get potato salad, and you have the lobsters. And I even have lobster plates with little lobsters on them.
Oh, that's very nice.
So that you,
that's
they have
really
paintings
nice.
Of lobsters on the plates. Mm-hmm. They're plastic, but they're hard plastic. So you put the lobster right in line with the plate design. It's
oh,
very
I love
nice.
That.
And they have instructions if you don't know how to do it. Because
mm-hmm.
lots of people don't need to be waiters
no,
on the cake.
No,
many people look at the lobster and they say, well, mm-hmm. what do I do now? So it tells you how to do it. But in any case, I don't know if you'd really feel right telling all your guests that they had a Walgreens lobster.
Well, you know, I don't even know if Walgreens has them. Can you imagine if Walgreens also has lobster bibs? And at the bottom of the bib, they have a picture of a lobster with a little, like a bottle of aspirin on it. 877-301-8970. Some combinations do work. I mentioned the IKEA thing.
Yeah.
There's a great place our colleagues came up. Osako's is in Davis Square in Somerville. You can bowl, and it's great. It's sort of like old-time bowling. It's wonderful. They have pizza, which is that flatbread pizza stuff, and fabulous, like, microbrewery
oh,
beer. That's like a perfect combination.
Or the place, Chestnut Hill. They're going to have the theater out in Chestnut Hill.
What's that?
Where you can eat during the performance.
Well, that works.
Tables. That really works. You know what I think is a weird thing? I'm
what's that?
Kind of obsessed with Whitey Bulger. I have learned now that these garages that were supposedly garages
mm-hmm.
were, in fact, buckets of blood. You know, they weren't taking very care of many cars in these garages. They were killing people in the upstairs room or threatening to kill them or putting them in chairs and tying their hands behind their back and torturing them for several hours.
877-301-8970. It seems to me the most common occurrence like this that people confront is you go to a gas station.
Uh-huh.
And you go to a gas station. And it took me years. Now it's commonplace. You go to a gas station and they have a something mart inside. And I tell you, you know, it's one thing you go inside and have a cup of coffee. But when you buy like real food or semi-real food inside the station where you filled your it's just that to me, you're making a face. That's sort of the same face you had when you tried the new Dunkin' Donuts glazed donut with egg and bacon this morning.
Well, you know what else doesn't really go, although it's a necessity and you often need them, but it's not a good combination.
What's that?
A gas station and a ladies' room.
Well, but
they're never quite the experience.
No, I understand that, but they perfectly
remember
fit.
Remember when Britney Spears walked into the ladies' room gas station barefoot? Oh, God.
So
877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. What do you think about buying a lobster at Walgreens? It is a good price. If you're having company for the lobster dinner, do you feel an obligation to tell them that it came from Walgreens, or do you want to, you know, pass it off as a legal seafoods lobster? I'm just not sure if that's correct. You have to decide that with your conscience. Let your conscience be your guide there, Jim.
We posted a question on our Twitter page. Would you buy a lobster at Walgreens? And Chris Ferrone, who's the great writer who wrote, you know, he's written about the occupiers and lots of, he's also written great stuff about the Tsarnaevs and the whole Boston. He says, I do it only if their sushi chef was out for the day. By the way, and if you think
they do have sushi.
I'm sorry.
Sushi
at
Walgreens?
I know. I know. Okay, let's start with Zane. Zane, you're in a car. Would you buy a lobster at Walgreens? Or what other kinds of odd combos have you encountered? Go ahead.
I don't believe I would actually buy a lobster from Walgreens. Uh-huh. I'd rather just go down to the dock and tell the fisherman, hey, I'll give you $5 a shot for the lobsters. And usually they go for that.
Have you done that?
Oh, of course.
I've actually never done that. I love that. Getting it right from the lobsterman?
Well, yeah, it works. It's win-win. You get it cheaper, and the fisherman gets, you know, more money because they sell it to the wholesaler for, you know, $3 or $4 a pound. So,
but let me ask you about Zane, and I think I'm with you, but let's assume you needed two things that day. You needed a lobster, and you needed foot sanitizer. Isn't it great that the Walgreens is like a one-stop? I don't think so either.
I guess I never really looked at it.
Well,
that
think
way.
About it, Zane, and get back to us in the near future. Thank you for the call.
We're getting emails, lots of them, from people with a very good point, Jim.
What's that?
You can go to the Star Market and buy lobsters. You can go to Stop and Shop and buy lobsters, and they also sell odor eaters. What's the difference?
No, but it's primarily a food establishment. By the way, I do not buy, I hate to disclose my personal things.
Oh, please do.
I do not buy drugstore items at the supermarket. I buy drugstore items at the drugstore.
Really?
That's the way I live my life. That's where you're supposed to get them.
What difference does it make?
It matters to me.
Oh, it does?
But by the way, I would say,
so your odor eaters are from CVS.
Buying aspirin at a Whole Foods or a Shaw's is a lot more palatable than buying a lobster at a downtown drugstore. And by the way, what we're talking about is it turns out that the Walgreens in Downtown Crossing sells live lobster. And neither Marjorie nor I can imagine going in there and buying one of these things, even though the price is totally right. $9.99 for the whole lobster, not per pound, which probably means the price per pound is $7-$8, which is really quite great.
Let's go to Alita. I hope that's pronouncing it right. In the car. Hi.
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 You pronounced it correctly.
Oh, good. Thank you.
The weirdest combo I ever saw was in a cobbler in a suburb of New York City, like a really old-fashioned shoe cobbler, and they also sold Kiehl skincare products, which are like a really high-end, you know, lotions and creams. It was very strange. I remember I bought a lip balm there, and the guy behind the counter explained to me that the secret ingredient in the lip balm was squalene, which was shark fat. So here I am buying these expensive cosmetics that turn out to be like filled with shark fat in a cobbler shop.
Cobbler meaning, for those that don't know, like a shoe repair kind of joint,
yeah.
Right? And by the way, Kiehl's, for those who don't know, is high-end. It's on Newbury Street, started in Lower Manhattan. It is really high-end and really expensive, but great stuff. Alita, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Joni from Worcester. What do you think about buying lobsters at Walgreens, Joni?
I don't think I could handle that, and I couldn't tell my guests.
No, you couldn't. You couldn't.
No, I don't think I could do that. But, you know, they're in my home state of New Hampshire, they have this great store that is a gunsmith, and they also do fine art framing, which is a good combo.
That's a good one.
And why I assume that comes from the fact that one sort of I could understand. I'm assuming the people who own the store, one of it has an interest in guns and one has an interest in art. I assume that's it, right? It's a couple or a family.
I'm assuming that's it. It's right near the Ruger factory in Newport. So.
Well, there you go. But you know, when you think about a Walgreens, it's not like the head of Walgreens, one of them says, I'm interested in deodorant, and the other says, I'm interested in crustaceans. It's just a decision they've made to co-sell these things, which is odd. Joni, thanks for the story.
Here's a local one. Edward just emailed this in, bpr@wgbh.org. Gaetano and Rocco's Barbershop on Salem Street in the North End serves sandwiches.
I sort of like that. I've never heard of that. I love that.
I wouldn't want that because you might get hair in your sandwich. You know, it's kind of like getting sand in your sandwich.
No, that's an issue.
Yeah.
That's a bit of a problem.
But anyway, I mean, I suppose you could kill two birds with one stone. Eat your sandwich while you're getting your hair cut.
You could.
Yeah.
So I was speaking to someone yesterday. This is a true story, and I can't say where, unfortunately. It's in Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
There's a woman who is a justice of the peace. I meant to tell you this morning. I forgot to tell you. A variation on this theme. A justice of the peace who performs weddings. That's on the second floor of her establishment. Guess what the first floor of her establishment is. You're going to die when you hear this. A funeral home. So essentially, I guess it's a beginning and an end kind of thing. You can get married on the second floor by the same woman who is the proprietor, the right word?
I guess the
head of the funeral home, which is on the first floor.
I don't think that's very good luck for your marriage going forward to get married above a funeral home.
Where are you getting married? I'm getting married at the Leiden Funeral Home on the second floor. And on the way, we're going to pick up the lobsters for the reception at Walgreens. I mean, just certain things don't fit.
I grew up with a kid whose father was an undertaker.
Yeah?
Yeah, I asked him if he went down and touched the bodies.
Is that true?
He said he did.
Okay. Who was in our studio a couple of days ago? I know this is an aside. Who's a very famous political analyst who started his career as an undertaker?
Michael Goldman.
That is correct. Big time Democratic political analyst.
David from Bridgewater. What do you think about buying lobsters at Walgreens?
I see nothing wrong with it. Go wherever it goes cheaper.
Good for you.
That's how I look at it.
You follow the price.
That's right. There's nothing wrong with that.
Now, have you done this or you say you would do it if the circumstances?
What's wrong with the pancake? The thing's clean.
Well, I guess that's true. You're a more straightforward, bottom line oriented kind of guy, David.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm sorry. What's that?
Thank you. I had a guy who used to live on our third floor when I was young. Mm-hmm. To help with the rent, and he used to buy fish at the local supermarket and cook them in the oven, and stunk up the whole house for like 3 days.
What's the point? What were you saying?
The point is, I mean, it's supermarket fish. You know what I mean?
Oh.
I mean, would you buy a piece of fish at the supermarket? Aren't you a little suspicious how long it's been there? What's in it?
No, seriously?
Sort of
I usually buy my fish at the Shell gas station. I guess I always find it to be the finest fish. Or maybe it's mobile. I'm not sure. But I find it them really
BP.
To have a great
BP.
And butchers.
A little oil spill.
Let's take one or two more here. John, you're in Paxton. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I spent some time in Afghanistan, and you know, you drive down these roads, and it's miles and miles long, and everybody has like these little shops. And at these shops, it would be like one guy selling watering cans, motorcycle tires, boom booms, which are like Red Bulls, and, you know, gasoline. And the guy right next door to him is selling the same thing, all the way down the line. And the whole time I'm thinking, like, why doesn't somebody specialize in each one of these, and it would be a lot better.
So essentially that they're general stores is what they are.
Exactly, but one right next to the other one all the way down. And I don't want to see that happen here, you know. So I think, you know, just keep the specialty to a maximum, you know.
John, thank you for the Afghanistan story.
Very much, John. Okay, we're going to switch up topics. We're going to be joined, as we are every Friday at 1 o'clock, by Emily Rooney from Greater Boston. We're going to talk to her. She's become our resident animal activist and bear hugger. Emily Rooney is up next on 89.7 WGBH.
GBH and the Boston Globe announced this year's Boston Summer Arts Weekend, a three-day festival of live music, arts, and great entertainment in Boston's Copley Square, presented by Citizens Bank. Mark the date now, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, July 26th, 27th, and 28th, a weekend you definitely want to stick around for. Check out the weekend lineup and After Dark events online at bostonsummerarts.com.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and EBSCOhost, informing the world and proud sponsor of Innovation Hub with Kara Miller, Saturdays at 10 a.m. and Thursdays at 9 p.m. on WGBH. To learn more about EBSCOhost and over 40 positions in technology currently available, you can visit EBSCOhost.com. An innuendo in Natick with the Hunter Douglas Lighter Side of Living event, featuring cordless LightRise Blackout Duet Arcatella, as well as motorized shades controlled from your smartphone. Innuendo.com.
She joins us. Oh, I forgot. Who are we? We're Jim Browdy and Marguerite.
We are.
It's Boston Public Radio. She joins us every Friday on Open Mic at about 1 o'clock. She's the host of Greater Boston, which you can see every night on GBH TV at 7. Tonight is Beat the Press, which we all love. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey,
oh,
Jim,
I'm sorry. Marguerite is a panelist. My apologies.
Oh, yeah, tonight
you're on Beat the Press.
That's right. I'm all excited.
Our star cast.
And I'm all excited about Emily's list and Emily's complaints.
Because but not quite yet.
They're not complaints.
No,
they're
observations.
They're observations.
Come
and
on.
I feel cleansed at the end of this segment every week. I want to know. Let's start with the...
We're not getting Emily's list
yet.
We have a few
yet.
Things we want to talk
we're
about.
We're going to talk about the young man down in...
Todeshev.
Yes, in Florida that was shot.
Yes.
What's your deal with that?
I am becoming like a Randy Weaver type survivalist.
I am 100% with you.
I've flipped about this. You know, with the government being so secretive and killing people without telling us what the heck is going on. I mean, this is not right. The FBI, the government, has an obligation to explain to us what happened, why this young man, they were interrogating him. He was unarmed. What happened? We have a right to know.
Well,
why don't we know?
Well, let's say what we do know. We do know that originally we were told he charged the FBI agent with a knife. Then we were told there were no knife. Then we were told he grabbed a samurai sword off the wall. And then we were told it wasn't that. The New York Times reported he grabbed a pole and turned over a table. But the point that is made, I'm so with you, Emily.
Even on that Randy Weaver thing, by the way, they told us blow by blow what happened. And I can remember at the time sort of being on their side. I've turned the tide on that one. But they told us what happened. You know,
well, also, and the critical issue to me is not just that they're not telling us, that Maria Sacchetti in The Globe did a great story yesterday in which she compared the absolute stonewalling in the Todeshev situation with what, as you're describing, every other situation where an FBI agent in the midst of an interrogation or talking to a suspect has killed the person.
Yeah.
They came out and stated the facts, at least their version of the facts.
There was a recent one where
immediately.
They came out and explained
And all the opening here is, well, I don't have to read the details. Every example she could come up with, they gave the information, which, by the way, you know what story has totally disappeared that I am obsessed with is we are to believe, it's a variation on this, that based upon what the FBI has leaked about what Todeshev said, that Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and Todeshev killed the three men in Waltham on the 10th anniversary of September 11th. Why should anybody believe? Maybe it is true, but based upon what we have been told and the silence since that's been leaked to us, why should we believe that's true?
I don't know, but we should know at this point, since the guy is dead, why can't he just tell us what happened?
Why can't the medical examiner release the report as they do in any other case about an autopsy that is involved, that has some public interest, as this certainly does? I mean,
well,
I
think, especially, Marjorie, after we've seen the alleged photographs from the autopsy.
Right.
Via the father, a friend of Tedeschev took the photos, allegedly, shipped them to the father. The father allegedly showed the alleged photographs, which demonstrate six shots to the torso, one to either the top or the back of the head, which merits some explanation.
It's plausible to me that the guy got frustrated and tipped a table. That's
It is
plausible to me. And then he lunged and this and that.
Yes, it is.
I still don't see why he had to kill him.
Well, you know something else that annoys me terribly about this case? We don't even have an explanation about why they were repeatedly questioning this guy for hours in his apartment.
And he got so annoyed that he said, next time you want to interrogate me, you're coming to my house because I'm not going down to your office ever again. And so they did. That's why they were there.
But that's a very strange thing. I mean, don't usually law enforcement take people to the police station
They had been taking him in. And he said, I'm done with this. You want to talk to me one more time? Because the father or the friend, I guess, explained that part of it. That's why they were at his house.
And let me just say, as Emily said, it is very possible that what they're saying is true. But they have to stand up and fill in the blanks for us, particularly when they're suggesting that two dead men are responsible for an unsolved, huge murder in Waltham. Now, Emily, this is almost from the sublime to the ridiculous. But I have to say, before we get to Emily's list, now whenever I read a story, I don't just read the story anymore. Yeah. I think WWES, right. What would Emily say? So Marjorie and I are talking about the piping plovers the other day in Duxbury and the whole issue of people who bought beach passes can't drive onto the beach anymore because of these little tiny birds. Where are you on the
first of all,
beach issue?
This is probably going to surprise you, but I'm something of a bird person. I just saw a great blue heron fly by, so I know birds. I know a lot. I mostly like birds of prey, but I'm a bird person.
That part doesn't surprise me.
Are you a bird watcher? Do you watch birds?
Birds of prey.
Really?
Owls, hawks.
I love owls.
I hate hawks.
I see owls, too, because I know where to look
for them. I live in fear he'll pick up my little 10-pound dog. No.
Anyway, so
I
have an affinity to birds, and I actually am sympathetic to this piping closer thing. And originally when I heard that they were closing the beach until July 15th, I thought, this is just absolutely ridiculous or crazy. And by the way, you can move nests. You know, this whole idea that they can only be in one place. No, you can pick up a nest and physically move it, and the bird will come back. So that's one of those old
wise
tales.
And prior years, by the way, they've closed just sections of the beach, not done
what
they did.
But as it turns out, I've sort of turned on this, it's only cars that aren't allowed on the beach. The people can still go. You can't walk where the nests are. So these people with the $300 passes, they're actually allowed to bring their car down and do tailgating. And it's still frustrating. I can see that. But at some point,
but they can't bring the car onto the beach. No. They can bring their car to an adjoining
parking
lot or something.
July 15th.
Yeah, and but I mean, it's still. I mean, these birds are going to take over the thing. It's like there's a way to protect the birds, and I'm sympathetic to the residents down there. I mean, for heaven's sakes, I got to live in Duxbury. You might as well get some pleasure out of that.
To read the great quote from this guy Don Beers, who's the harbor master.
Is it that bad?
It was pretty beautiful, but it's a long ways away.
It is a long ways away. That's true. They should give him a cut rate. They should make him pay $300. They
should give them their money back.
No, not the whole thing.
Give them their money back.
$225 or $200 because they can go after July 15th.
But still, I mean, that's half the summer. The summer's over after July 4th.
What? Oh, God.
Let me just read this quote since I promised. This is a good quote.
It's 50 degrees.
It's the harbor master, Don Beers, of this particular harbor, Duxbury. It only takes four nests to bring Duxbury to its knees. That's a pretty good line. In any case, this is really what you tune in for when Emily Rooney is here. Here it is, Emily's list.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Well, we do have a huge interest. Here it is. If you've just tuned in for the first time, Emily, at the end of her segment or the middle of her segment every week, she produces Emily's List, which are a list of, as you say, observations.
They're not complaints,
Marjorie. They're observations. So what are they this week, please, Emily?
All right. Well, we talked earlier in the week about this Newton Bear shooting that happened last Sunday morning right near Exit 16 off the Massachusetts Turnpike. As you know, I was really riled up about it, Jim and Marjorie, so I actually went out to the site myself to see, you know, exactly if it were as described. Well, as it turns out, the tree is closer to the Mass Turnpike than I thought. Still, there was a you know, one of those fences. So the tree is quite tall. Still, there's a fence. And then there's the railroad track. There's absolutely no way, impossible for that bear to get onto the Massachusetts Turnpike. That was not going to happen. So that's one thing.
Can't they climb fences, bears?
This was a Jersey, you know, barrier. It just wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, okay. Did you see, by the way, you're leaving this topic? Because before you leave it, the Globe did an editorial
on this. I know.
I've
got that on my list here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So they shoot and they kill this bear. And by the way, I spoke to an eyewitness who used to work here, Sanjay Solomon. Sanjay saw the bear running along near exit 16. He stops on the turnpike to take a picture of it. The bear disappears. He gets off at exit 16, turns around, follows him down, goes down to Eddy Street and Washington Street. By then, the environmental police are already there. According to Sanjay, they get out this dart gun. They shoot the bear twice. Bang. Bang. He says within 30 seconds of that last tranquilizer, they got out that Remington 870 and shot the thing out of the gun. So there was no discussion. They didn't have time to discuss this. And Sanjay said, how do they know the tranquilizer didn't work? It was so – they shot that bear so fast.
That's horrible.
Now, contrast this with what happened in New Jersey this week. A bear was in a tree, exact same situation, in a residential neighborhood. They get out their tranquilizer guns. Not only that, remember we were talking, Marjorie, earlier this week about how in Brookline they let the bear fall to the ground 80 feet.
Yes.
And by the way, there was another example of that in California where the bear died after it fell. This in one in New Jersey, they got the big net. So, you know, they get the tranquilizer, they shoot the thing, and it falls into the net. These are environmental police. There are more and more bears in neighborhoods. You know, it's not their fault. You know, they're not criminals. They're bears.
Isn't there a difference between black bears and brown bears in terms of aggressiveness?
Yes, and grizzly bears.
Yes, this is a black bear that supposedly is less aggressive or not aggressive.
It was a little baby.
It was
a
baby
cub.
Bear.
It was a 120
pound. Didn't people see Yogi Berra when they were little?
Now, there was a couple other, just to be fair, into our environmental police here. There was two others recently, one in Seaside, California, where they where a bear came into a backyard. They didn't give that bear a chance. It weighed 400 pounds. They shot that one dead. And then there was one in New Mexico that entered a woman's bedroom and mauled her. But here's what they did on that one. The bear left the house and ambled back to the woods. They got scent dogs, tracked it, and then shot and killed it when they found it. Why? What is wrong with us?
I think there's a – I'm
going
to get in trouble for saying
say
that
it.
There's sort of a male macho
– I said that and got in trouble last week.
Thing going
men
on.
And their guns. I'm sorry.
Men and their guns.
Shooting.
It's your fault,
animals.
Jim.
Yeah.
By the way, just a little programming note. Emily forgot. Next Wednesday, and seriously, on Greater Boston, it's a special hour-long edition. It's called The Bear and Me, the Emily Rooney Story.
This. Here's my headline of the day. Guess what I forgot to tell you.
What?
So I'm coming up, you know, up to WGBH this morning, and I pull up in front of this car, and the bumper sticker, I could not make this up, says... Support your right to arm bears.
Boy, that is on
Let's
that
get
is
one
really
of those.
The greatest support your right to arm bears. Yeah. Can you imagine if that bear was sitting up there in the tree with an AK-47? All right, come and get me, guys. I got mine. Can you imagine?
Everybody else has one. There's no reason the bear should.
Give it to the bear.
I want one of those.
I know.
I feel so badly for this bear.
By the way, you know,
I
have to say I'm getting much closer the more I read. I'm serious to your position. Yours and Marjorie's. Is anybody being called to account here?
No.
I mean, I've read the editorials. No. I know you've done it, but there isn't – nobody's been disciplined or questioned.
Well, you heard what happened. They got the most unbelievable, vulgar, vile – you talk about comments on newspapers. These people called in – to the Newton police, the environmental police, and left, you know, outrageous
critical of the environmental
cops. Critical of their behavior, yeah.
They said they had to...
They wouldn't come on my show. I asked.
The critics?
No, the environmental
police.
Well, their excuse was that the gun misfired, and that's why they had to shoot the...
Do you believe that?
Tranquilizer gun. No, not based on what the eyewitness account you just gave us to Sanjay.
You call Angel Memorial or someplace that's open 24/7. You can't tell me you can't find a tranquilizer gun.
Excellent investigative work, Emily. No, I'm serious. She left us... You did it the same day?
I did.
The same day.
And I had all that other bear information.
That's incredible.
See, that
really
was an observation, Marjorie, not a complaint.
You should win a Pulitzer Prize.
I don't know if
you are doing the investigative work that needs
loving
to be done here.
Loving this, and I've also done some research. So the 2014 Susan G. Komen Walk for Breast Cancer was canceled in Boston and five other cities. Yep. Now, they're saying that in recent years they haven't raised enough money, and also that their event, Race for the Cure, which happens in the fall, is their main fundraiser. So, and also, as you may remember, earlier this month, actually it was April, I think, the Walk for Hunger here in Boston, which usually attracts like 10,000 people, they complained that their walk did not raise the kind of money it used to. They were blaming the one fund.
By the way, let me just correct some of your words, because Ellen Parker's with us. She's the head of Project Bread and the Walk. She wouldn't say complaining or whatever. She would say the reality is so much money has been focused.
I don't believe that.
Well, I mean, that's the way she put it.
My observation is this.
What's that?
People are sick of these walks, and they don't want to do it.
Look at Marjorie smiling.
They'll write the check. I mean, I'm very generous. They'll write the check to Susan G. Komen or the Walk for, or the Hunger Foundation, whatever it is. But these walks are a nuisance, and they're pointless. They're pointless.
Now, by the way, I think
Komen had a couple of
walking
other problems
to nowhere
there, too.
Komen had that problem with the Planned Parenthood. But you know what?
It was
five other cities and the pink thing. And,
yeah,
but this is a broken model. This walking thing. There are a lot of broken models for fundraising.
Well, by the way, not only has Marjorie Egan written about that extensively, but Scott Lehigh did a piece in The Globe a couple of years ago in which he said exactly that. Write a check. Stay out of my neighborhood. But you know what the response? We asked Ellen Parker about this a couple of years ago.
She said,
you won't get as much because it's part of the actual physical participation with other human beings that causes people to be as generous as they are. So there is an inconvenience.
Half the walkers don't give anything. They raise money
from
people.
Oh, well, so what? Yeah, but they still, because they exert themselves and they raise money.
And they ask you to contribute to their walk.
Yeah. Well, you get deluged. I mean, there are people knocking your doors and so forth looking for money. And of course, they do
walk up
the streets.
I'm not going to miss it. Can I just say?
Yeah, I was not happy with Komen when I found out they were trying. I mean, a breast cancer organization trying to take money away from Planned Parenthood to do mammograms.
For low-income women.
What were they thinking?
They did reverse that.
Now, let me ask you, just in the spirit of full disclosure here, we know the reason Marjorie has this position is she lives a block from most of the paths on Beacon Street in Brookline. You live very close to the path of a lot of these walks,
all of them. You're severed from the city.
It is about you, correct?
Well, I mean, in addition to the marathon is one thing. That divides the city. No, it's beyond that. It's a nuisance.
Who wants to be severed from the city, Jim?
Yeah, exactly.
Severed.
Exactly.
Remember a couple of years ago when it took me 5 hours to drive to NECN from our other radio station because of the marathon.
It was the marathon. You can't get across the marathon route. You have to drive all the way to Hopkinton.
I drove to Columbus, Ohio to get back to Newton. Okay, what else do you have on your list?
I'm going to do this for Beat the Press tonight, but I actually had the idea first to do it here, and I started thinking, well, there's such a great video, unfortunately. But how do you feel about Storm Chasers, the video? I mean, are you just like, oh, my gosh, when you see it, it's like...
It's
riveting.
I'm a hypocrite about this because I do love to watch the storm chasers. I find it so exciting to see those close-ups of the tornadoes. But then when you find out that these guys that were very senior and very safe in their approach were killed, three of them, and you saw the car that they were in.
Most of the people who are chasers are yahoos, as it turns out. About 80% of them are, thrill seekers and that kind of thing. They do have video cameras.
But not the guys that died, right?
Not the guys that died. Yeah. Those three were legitimate scientists with National Geographic. But I was sort of thinking about sort of our responsibility with this, as broadcasters and media people. It's like last week, and I did this compilation for tonight, I couldn't believe the amounts of video that were available and how we sort of hunger and lust for this because it's so dramatic. And yet... we, in a sense, are marketing this stuff and,
Well, I interviewed a guy the other night who left Oklahoma and knew the guy and the famous scientist whose name escapes me. My apologies for it. Who was one of the
Tim Samaras.
Samaras, right. He knows the guy and he was his inspiration, he says Samaras was. He left on Friday because he had to come back for a graduation or something or he would have been there. He not only is a chaser, he leads tours of people who are just normal
people. Is he a
local
guy?
He's a local
guy. I've talked to him before. That's dangerous. That's like climbing Mount Everest when
you
don't know
what
you're doing.
When you have no skills, I agree with that completely.
Yeah, just a bunch of bottle, of cans of oxygen on your back.
I'm with you.
Anything else? You
I do have one complaint.
Any other observation? Okay.
Oh, this is a complaint.
I love this.
Do either of you use your horn? Do you honk at people?
Occasionally, but I tap it very lightly when I do, really, really lightly.
Do not ever honk at me.
Why? Okay.
For any reason.
Okay, fine.
I'm about ready to. Sorry. Next person who honks at me, I'm going to get out of the car. Unfortunately, I'm not armed, but I wish I were. I'm going to go up to the window and say,
AK-47.
What are you thinking?
What was the circumstance that caused you to be this upset, Emily?
Like this, it happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
I'm in a long, long line of traffic, and I let a car's length go in front of me. Probably because I'm texting. No, I don't know. I wasn't texting. But there's this school bus in back of me.
Yeah.
And it's like laying on the horn. So I move up another 15 feet. Like, you're going to be able to go through the light faster than me if I move up. It's like that kind of thing. useless nonsense honking. If you're, you know, if you're about to hit somebody at an intersection or some dramatic situation, maybe. But
wait a second, you're about to hit someone, maybe you should honk your horn?
Or somebody's about to hit you, sure.
Well, no, it isn't maybe. The answer is yes, you use your horn. Excessive, can we agree, excessive use of horns.
90% of honking is useless.
Do you agree with this, Marjorie? You're not weighing in at all.
Well, you know what you do.
What's that?
You hit their bumper.
I occasionally have tapped cars in front of me, very lightly.
I would be okay with that.
A light tap.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I have a zen approach to traffic. I figure it's one of the things you can't do.
That's why I say don't honk
about.
At me. I get really upset.
Okay, not... so we won't honk at you. Right, okay, good, you made the good. Point.
I don't
so,
want to die,
except for people
Emily.
Who do U-turns okay. in front of the Boston Globe. And,
in front of the – because Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, was there. And Emily, before you go away, Marjorie is one of your panelists.
Yes,
tonight.
We're going to have all the great video of the storm chasers.
Yeah, we're going to do that.
I love to watch it. I
also,
must admit,
have you seen this video of the Providence – TV reporter.
Just tell people quickly. This is unbelievable.
I'm going to beat the press tonight. Exactly.
So this woman does this thing which we call in the business door knocking. It's a horrible thing we do in the news business. But when there's been tragedy in a family, you go and knock on the door and you ask for comment. Oftentimes, as Marjorie knows, people are more than willing to talk. But if they're not and they don't want to talk, you should go away.
Right.
This reporter did not go away. And she ended up in a very dramatic situation. Woman started throwing rocks at her and then sicked her two pit bulls on her.
Oh.
And then the reporter made the story all about herself, which was not the right thing to do. Anyway, we've got this dramatic video tonight.
Okay, but in the interim, don't honk if you see.
No, do not.
Emily, if you want to wave to her, yell at her,
exactly.
do something, don't
give
honk.
Me the finger, do not honk.
Emily, it's great
Emily
to see
Rooney,
you. Thanks so
much. Emily Rooney and Emily's increasingly famous list is with us every Friday at 1 o'clock,
goodness.
And it's going to be a great Beat the Press tonight.
See you
okay,
later.
Thank see you very much, Emily. We've been talking a lot about the need for government transparency from the FBI's handling of the Boston bombing to the planes flying over Quincy. We still don't know why they were flying over Quincy. But when our governor tells us about his night on the town, he gets in trouble. Stay tuned.
The White House says the NSA needs to collect citizens' phone records to protect the country from terrorist threats. But is it in our best interests, or is it just Big Brother? We'll call up the barbershop guys and see what they have to say next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Boston Landmarks Orchestra, kicking off their summer season with a free special concert, The Witness Cantata by Swanee Hunt, at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain, Sunday, June 9th at 2 p.m., landmarksorchestra.org. And Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close at hand. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The news quiz, the Friday news quiz, just about 10 minutes away. But first, as Marjorie says, we were talking a lot about transparency at all levels of government. We spent a lot of time doing that, particularly since the marathon. Well, the governor went transparent earlier this week. He was visiting a Cambridge marketing firm. And in his remarks to the group, he said, quote, he got quite drunk eating alone in a restaurant in Western Massachusetts the day after the capture of Jihar Tsarnaev. He was asked, I guess, a day or two after that speech, and the article appeared, the original article appeared in the Boston Herald. After that speech, he was asked about it. Here he is speaking to reporters about those comments.
Human beings sometimes do things like that. I went out to Western Massachusetts and relaxed, and it was marvelous.
And that's the deal. And by the way, if you don't know the story, he says he went out to dinner by himself. He had his book on an iPad. The person who owns the restaurant, who I guess he knows, said, do you want to sit with people or, you know, around people or alone? He said, I want to sit alone in a corner. And he sat there and had a few drinks. She subsequently told the Herald he was not intoxicated, but he himself used the words, I was, quote, quite drunk. He'll be with us next Thursday. I'm sure we'll talk about this when he's in the studio. But, you know, Marjorie, we wouldn't even have talked about this, but I was shocked when I read the story in the Herald and I talked to colleagues and friends. I would say maybe 30% of them were upset about the story, either that, which I can't understand, that the governor ever went out and got drunk. And by the way, he did not drive. He had a state trooper who was his driver,
right.
So don't focus on that. And secondly, another tier of people said, well, even if he chose to, quote, get drunk, he shouldn't be telling the public about this. I couldn't agree more. It's one of the most human stories that Deval Patrick has ever told since he's talked about his childhood in Chicago. He's basically said, I'm like everybody else. I had a week of incredible tension, and the way I relieved that tension, at least in part, is I went to my house in Western Massachusetts. I went out to dinner by myself with a favorite book, and I had a couple of drinks. I mean, that's what normal people would do, no?
I'm dying to know what people think about this at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
Are you upset about this at all?
Well, no, because I get it. I told you the story about, you know, we were all working long hours. Everybody was working long hours, you know, the first responders and obviously the families that were dealing with this crisis. I mean, I'm not putting my working in the newspaper and working at the radio station that level at all, but they were long days. And for one night, I didn't get through work till about 10 o'clock at night, and I had an open bottle of white wine in the refrigerator, and I started doing the normal thing, which is go get the bottle, get a glass, have a glass of wine before I went to bed. I went over to the refrigerator, I put it in the bottle, I just swigged.
Perfect.
Because I thought the tension, and, you know, I don't think I have a drinking problem. I think it was just a reaction. So I'm not sure if people are upset about because we're very puritanical about drinking.
Maybe it sets a bad example, and so he shouldn't have spoken about it, even if he did
the governor,
they say.
Or because there is a certain mentality, and if you know people that are in recovery, the mentality about drinking is that any kind of drinking to relieve stress or to cope with the situation is bad. That means you've got a problem. And
well, let me tell you, I was talking to non-puritanical people, mostly 30-somethings and 40-somethings.
Yeah.
And again, they weren't appalled. It wasn't like they were saying impeach the guy, but they were upset. But I guess in retrospect, they were primarily upset with the fact that he talked about it. If he felt that he wanted to do it to relieve the tension, and I'll tell you, how would you like to have been the boss, the chief executive of Massachusetts during that week? I don't think so. And so finally, Tamerlan Tsarnaev is killed. Jihar Tsarnaev is captured in that boat in Watertown, and the guy is basically trying to blow off a little bit of steam and stress. 877-301-8970. We'll talk to anybody, particularly if there's somebody out there who shares the sentiments that I encountered yesterday and you're upset about any part of this. I'd love to hear. Marjorie would love to hear, too, the analysis. Let's start in Newport, Rhode Island. Drew, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Drew.
Hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think it's totally fine that he went out and had a couple of glasses of wine or beer or whatever he was drinking, and, you know, as long as he's not driving, and, you know.
Yeah, I do too. And maybe it's the governor thing that people are just upset because he's the governor of the Commonwealth or something like that, that you're not supposed to be using this as some kind of a crutch. But I think it's absolutely fine, too. Drew, thank you very much for the call.
What again? Well, whatever. What would anybody else do? You go to things that relieve stress. Everybody's got a different deal. We don't have to go down what the list is.
They go running, or they go watch a movie, or they listen to their iPod by themselves.
What book do you think? We have to ask him what book he was reading. None of the stories identify what the book was on his iPad.
Someone
aren't you dying
that
to know?
Detail. Leila from Watertown, what do you think about this? Is it bother you that Deval Patrick tied one on out there in the
tie one on? Go ahead. Go ahead,
got completely wasted and went to the strip club. No.
Yeah, smashed. Plastered.
Go ahead, Leila.
Who cares? I mean, everybody has to, like, release stress on that. And you have to, you know, who cares who's drinking, you know? If he was smoking pot, there might be an issue. But even then, who really cares? He's not doing anybody any harm.
Right. It's not like he went to Newton and shot a bear out of a tree or something. There we'd be upset.
That's right.
If he went and shot bears, it might be different.
Know? I can't see Deval with his little bong. I somehow can't envision that.
Can
you?
No, I don't think that's happening.
But I think now it's not. It is still illegal if you're under an ounce. Right? You get
marijuana.
A fine, but you don't get arrested.
It's decriminalized is what it was. Leila, we agree with you. Thank you so much for the call.
David in Arlington, what do you think about the governor having a couple of Chardonnays to relax out there at the end of the marathon week?
Well, first of all, I can't get the image of Governor Patrick with a bong out of it. I mean, you know, really, and this is, I grew up in New Orleans. I moved up here 25 years ago, and I still am impressed by this region of the country's dual nature with alcohol. You were talking earlier in the show about alcohol licenses and such like that. You know, you're right. You said it earlier. This is what people do. But more importantly, there's become a bigger thing, and it's left this region of the country where Americans somehow think that you shouldn't get drunk, yet that's the whole idea of selling alcohol. So I don't know what they think is happening.
Well, I thought you were supposed to get a manageable buzz on. Wasn't that you're supposed to do? Like I always tell my kids, drink slowly when you're in college, you know, slowly.
But he also is a state trooper who's a driver. Yeah, right. So if anybody could do it and do it safely, one would argue this guy could do it. Huh, David?
Well, yeah, I would say that. And two, you know, for some people, a buzz on is being drunk. I mean, you know, if you don't drink a lot, I mean, for me, a bottle of wine is the beginning of the evening. So.
David, Margie would like your number. She'll be in touch later. David, thank you so much for the call.
Well, you, for a big guy.
Pound per pound.
You have like a half a beer, and you have to carry him out in a stretcher.
But that's actually a wonderful thing. Let's go to Providence.
Speaking of carrying people out in the stretchers, remember when Bill Weld was down at the Rolling Stones concert? And they literally had to carry him out in the stretcher.
Well, no, he was giving a commencement speech at some college, and he passed out. Now, apparently it was because of the heat.
Bad ice cube.
I remember that line. He was spectacular. Jess, you're in Providence, Rhode Island. We're getting people's impression of the governor saying he was quite drunk in Western Mass the night after the capture of Jahar Tsarnaev.
Hi, yeah. I'm not an expert of any sort besides being a card-carrying member of AA. But I would be more worried if he was having a drink before he was caught while we were searching.
You know, Jess, you're the perfect person to talk to. Have you been sober for a while, for a few years?
I have not been sober that long. I am newly sober.
Okay.
I've tried it before in the past, white knuckling it.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't for me at that time.
Well, the reason I ask is because some people that are in AA and they're in recovery and they're sober, they're very suspicious of almost any reason for drinking. That's why I ask.
Oh, well, I mean, you're going to have those people anywhere, like Mitt Romney. But,
yeah, but that's a religious thing. I mean, in all fairness
know,
to the
I'm
governor.
Just, no,
I know
no,
you're
I'm
kidding.
Just,
I know.
I'm
I know.
Just kidding.
Okay. So you're not suspicious?
No. I mean, our mission is to help other alcoholics stay sober. We don't want to prohibit anybody that can handle it and drink in safety, as the governor did.
As he did.
With his driver. We don't want to prevent that from... We have no mission with that regard. So.
Jess, thanks for sharing your insight with us. We really appreciate it. So, I mean, there's a much more tolerant group calling today than those whom I encountered yesterday.
Must be your friends.
It's not, no.
Are they
it's
all in Cambridge?
No, they're
Central
no, it's
Square?
Not all. No, they were not. No, they were normal,
Square?
Average people from a variety of
locales.
Square
and Kendall Square.
Doesn't matter where they were, Marjorie. Those were the conversations. I'll leave it there.
Okay. Up next is our Friday News Quiz. This is going to be great. Well, we've got the Boston Globe Society and party photography. You know all those great pictures you see on the Globe website? They're taken by Bill Brett. And Bill Brett is going to face off with Jim Botticelli, the curator of this fantastic photography sensation called Dirty Old Boston. Two Tales of One City is our theme. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan, and it is time for our Friday News Quiz. Today's theme is a tale of two cities. In one corner, representing the shiny, sparkly, I guess high society Boston, is Boston Globe great photographer Bill Brett. You can see his party and event pictures from around town in the online photo galleries at Boston.com. In the Globe, Bill, it's great to see you.
Thank you.
It's embarrassing. I can't even admit. You know what the first thing I look at every day on Boston.com?
You're like an addict.
And I have to hide them when my bosses walk by. I should be doing work as opposed to looking at party pictures.
Good. We need the views.
Well, you're getting plenty from me. And representing the other city, and I just saw this guy's stuff in the last 24 hours. It's fabulous. That'd be dirty old Boston. It's Jim Botticelli. He's a retired Boston public school teacher, the man behind the Facebook page called Dirty Old Boston. It's an online collection of photographs of the city before it was gentrified. Jim, it's great to meet you, and thanks so much for coming.
Oh, my pleasure.
Before we start, tell us about some of your favorite pictures that you got on your website, because they're old and they're fantastic, and they're scenes from Boston, like way some of them back to the 30s.
Yeah, we go back to the 30s, but mostly we concentrate from about 1945 to 1987 when the Orange Line came down. Some of my favorites are the dirtier pictures of like dirty parking lots,
yeah,
crumbling buildings in the South End. Things that you would never see anymore in those areas of town.
You know, I've even forgotten what the elevated Orange Line looked like, and it was right near the Herald for all those years.
That's right, that's right.
Great big shadow.
Yeah, great big shadow.
Now, Bill, in addition to doing great books of Bostonians, which we all love, and you can tell us about that in a couple of minutes and how people can get them, what are your favorites? I mean, you have taken pictures of everybody in this city at different events. I mean, I know you hate the question.
I know his favorite.
But what is your favorite? What's a favorite handful of things you've done?
Well, my favorite, people always ask that question. I said I have many, many favorites. But one of my iconic favorites is the Three Bears.
I knew you were going to say that. That is a great picture.
That's actually, I think it's one of my iconic photographs of the Three Bears walking through the public garden.
Which you have a great smile on your face as you're saying.
I was thrilled to make it, and I was honored to make it because it'll never be made again.
Is that the one at Doyle's?
Yes.
I've seen it.
It's Kevin White.
It's Kevin White.
Ray Flynn.
And Tom Menino.
And Tom Menino.
I love that picture, too. That's great.
Hey, I posted a picture of Ray Flynn eating a burger. Wow. Somebody sent it to me.
On Castle Island at Sullivan's?
It didn't say where, but probably.
Probably.
I have a lot of pictures of me eating burgers that I've taken myself, which I can share with you.
There's so many photographs. People say, oh, it's your best photograph. And I said, I have to be honest about it. I haven't made it yet. Every day I'm looking for it.
I like that. I like that.
Every day I'm looking for it.
I like it a lot.
I'm looking for it.
What's your favorite column, Marjorie? You say, God. I haven't written it yet. That's what you're supposed to say.
I haven't written it yet. Okay. Let's get started. I wrote it in 1982. Yes. Actually, it's all been downhill.
Why don't we do a Herald Globe thing? Why don't you ask questions of Bill, and I will ask questions, a Jim-to-Jim kind of thing, Marjorie.
Okay, here we go, Bill. You ready?
I'm ready.
We're going to let Jay Leno set up this next question.
This is so disgusting. Just testing a new food item. A glazed donut egg sandwich. It's an egg between two glazed donuts. And if it tests well, it's going to be used in prisons as a form of lethal injection. So that's it. I'll give you a couple of these.
Okay, here's the question. This sandwich did so well in beta mode, it's being added to its permanent menu. Today, it makes its national debut. And do you know what franchise is behind this concoction?
McDonald's.
That would be wrong. Oh. You can steal the question, Jim. Do you know where it is?
Donkeys.
That is correct. And by the way, you can see all six of us on the Boston Public Radio team on our Facebook page sampling them this morning, and you get our reactions as well, which were not that mixed, actually.
They were.
I should have checked that
out.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was awful.
Now, Jim Botticelli, you ready for your first question?
Sure.
One of the world's most powerful men is now an eligible bachelor. He's got a 6th-degree judo black belt. He's been known to shoot guns, fish, and play hockey in his spare time. Here he is yesterday announcing his availability.
My job and all my activities mean I'm an absolutely public figure. Some people enjoy this and some don't. My wife, Ludmilla, has done a 9-year shift by my side. The decision was mutual.
Okay, the question's quite simple, Jim. Who is the man?
Sure, that's Vladimir Putin.
Of course it is Vladimir Putin. Now, he and his wife had not appeared together in ages, and they appeared together to say they're not going to appear together anymore.
I know.
Did you ever take a picture of the Putins?
No, I haven't seen them.
Is it the Putins or the Putins?
I think it is Putin.
Putins. Putins, Putins. I don't believe this for a second.
My Russian's a little rusty.
Jim, you must have been a good teacher.
How long were you a teacher, by the way?
30 years.
Oh.
In Boston?
Boston Public.
Which school?
Boston Public, baby. Well, that last one was West Roxbury High.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
That's not the one off the VFW Parkway.
It is. Yeah. Looks like a prison from the road.
It does look like a prison from the road. It is. How's it look inside?
Dirtier.
Take a photo. Take a photo on your Facebook page.
Pretty
gum under everything.
Okay, Bill Brett, you have to start catching up here. Ready?
Oh, geez, these are tough ones.
Go ahead, Marjorie.
Okay, here's Conan O'Brien. In this clip, who is Conan O'Brien talking about?
In a new interview...
says his throat cancer, he had throat cancer, he's better now, but his throat cancer was caused by performing oral sex on too many women.
Look at Bill.
You're supposed to say that would
be
me.
The interview appears in the Journal of Overcompensating for having just played Liberace.
Jeez, that's a good one.
Who's he talking about, Bill Brett?
You got me on that one.
Jim Botticelli knows this one.
Oh, I know.
Who is that?
It's Michael Douglas.
That is true.
Well, I was going to take a shot at him because I met him one day, and I said, it's funny, I was thinking of him.
Well, also, there was a piece in the Boston, on Boston.com that said Michael Douglas TMI, meaning too much information. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? I mean, Marjorie Egan, the Boston Herald occasionally deals in places where others would not go. Isn't this TMI?
Well, it is, but I think he has performed a public service to some degree because I think most people did not know that that kind of cancer he had, that's where 70% of it comes
70%?
From.
70%?
Really?
All right, well, let's leave it right there.
Yeah.
I think we should move on to the next question.
What an educational show. Yeah,
exactly.
At least that is what I read in the stories about Michael Douglas this week.
Really?
So I did not independently verify that, but that's what I read in the stories.
Fine. And by the way, if people didn't see the Liberace movie, did any of you see the Liberace
thing?
No, it's
supposed to be great.
With him playing Liberace and Matt Damon, Cambridge Zone, playing his Scott, whatever his name is, they were both fabulous. I mean, it was really a terrific movie. Do you think it was good or no, Jimbo?
I liked it. It was a little soapy, but it was good.
It was soapy, but I thought they were both just terrific. Okay.
You're talking about the bathtub scene?
Well, no, actually.
Among others.
Every scene.
Among others.
Okay, Jim Botticelli, you're doing incredibly well here. You can build your lead with the following. We're going to play you a montage, and we want to know, what are these residents of Newton, Massachusetts talking about, please?
I think they just should have waited until it came down from the tree, given it time to come down.
It was a scary situation, but I suppose they didn't have much of a choice other than to kill it.
Now, there always are other options, and it wasn't posing any threat. It was on a tree. It probably would have stayed there for as long as you would want it to stay there.
Okay, now Emily Rooney just left us. She's really up in arms about this. You know what they were all talking about?
Yeah, I was talking with Bill about it, actually, in the waiting room. He actually knows more about it than I do, but I know they're talking about the bear shooting in Newton.
Okay, the unanimity in the studio, ultimately I came on board. I was more of an agnostic about it in the beginning. This was a horrible idea. The environmental police didn't wait long enough. What's your take on this, Bill Brett?
Well, I don't think they had the proper equipment with them.
Yeah. I mean the tranquilizing equipment. So do you think at the end of that sentence is then, under the circumstances, they had to do what they did, or they should be blamed for having brought the wrong stuff to the fair?
Of each. I mean, I think that this happened in Fenway Park back a few years ago.
In Fenway Park?
Yeah, it wasn't tranquilizer where they used the, when they had the allegedly a riot that took place after one of those games where the girl was shot.
Oh, of course.
And the gun they used, there was a problem with it. So it wasn't a tranquilizer.
Victoria Snellgrove. Yeah.
Snellgrove, that's exactly right. That's right.
And that was a big discussion of what type of a weapon to use.
What kind of weapon was it? I forget what sort of a gun
wasn't
it was.
Wasn't it a pepper?
A pepper spray gun. But it didn't really do what they expected it to do.
And but it was great controversy. It was the photograph that appeared of her dead, I believe, in the Herald. And I have to say, I was on your – I mean, it shows the horror of that kind of action. It brought it home.
Well, you must have gotten into those over the years as a photographer, the debates over which photographs are too graphic to show.
Talking to Bill Brett now.
Sure did.
And which ones aren't. I tend to err on the side of let's show people what happened.
I think
we have the same problem on the Facebook page.
Really?
If you show a picture that people don't like, showed a picture of a couple of police dragging a body out of Boston Harbor back in 1962. Yeah, people were up in arms about it. The comments section.
Really?
It's just,
the way
they don't want to see it.
And you know, you're talking about. I mean, I think in this particular story, just recently in the bombing on the marathon, a lot of the photographs were very graphic.
And they were
used.
Yeah.
Because that was the first time that we've seen something like that in America, other than 9/11. And John Tomaki, who was down at the scene, he was on the ground, and he made some very, very graphic photographs. But and there was a lot of discussion about how to use them, and they did use quite a few of them.
Well, remember the debate about the photograph, speaking of bodies getting dragged, of Charles Stewart getting picked up after he jumped off the Mystic River bridge, the Tobin Bridge, I should say, into the Mystic River. And people that forget, he was the one who shot his wife in the back of the head after the birthing class, and he jumped off the Tobin Bridge. Or some people think he was pushed off the Tobin Bridge.
Okay, let's
think about that, Bill.
Yeah, there was a lot of speculation, but I think there was enough witnesses to show that he did jump off them.
Okay.
Now, Bill, you're going to start to cut into Jim Botticelli's lead with this question. Governor, you were asking the question. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Here's Governor Patrick speaking to reporters about his drunken evening after the bombing manhunt ended.
Got drunk after they caught
Joe Karsarniev over in Watertown. So when he tells you, when he was the one that was the source of this,
we did the wrong thing. That was it was.
Oh, did I goof it up?
Let's go to the. No, you didn't goof it up. Let's go to the next question, Margaret.
Go to the next question. Okay, the one about a montage.
Whatever the next one is.
Okay, we're going to play a montage of three clips. Identify what this is a montage of and why it's in the news this week.
I am tired of working for candidates who make me think I should be embarrassed to believe what I believe. Because somebody came along and said liberal means soft on crime, soft on drugs, soft on communism.
Chuckles the Clown is dead. It was a freak accident. He went to the parade dressed as Peter Peanut. And a rogue elephant tried to shell him.
I simply cannot eat the same food every day. Fish, liver, day after day. I've eaten a river of liver and an ocean of fish. I've eaten so much liver, I can only make love if I'm smothered in bacon and onions.
Okay. Okay. Do you know what this is a montage of and why it's in the news this week? This is a tough one.
I have no idea.
These questions of Bill Brett, Jim Botticelli. Do you know?
Of course I don't.
Of course I don't. Thank
I don't
you.
Know either.
Yes, it is. These are television shows which were voted amongst the 101 best written shows by the Writers Guild of America.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And we actually did a show on that yesterday, Margaret. Were you here for that or were you not?
So with all fairness, since I don't watch television, the only shows I watch are yours.
Oh, thank you very much.
I watch my brother Jim's.
So wait a second. If you watch Jim Brett's show and mine, give him the points. Yeah. I think that's all you really need to know.
I'm not a TV person.
Okay, now here's what we do. We go to the lightning round here, and it's a tale of two cities. Since Jim Botticelli is documenting the dirty pre-gentrification Boston, and Bill Brett captures the dazzling, sparkly, high society Boston and others, for our lightning round, we're asking each of you questions about Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. Why don't you do the first one to Bill, please, Marjorie.
Okay, here we go, Bill. A Tale of Two Cities has been adapted hundreds of times. Which among these three is a true adaptation of Dickens' classics? We got A, B, and C, okay? And then you choose one. A, the 1996 Lifetime miniseries starring Kathy Bates and Albert Finney. B, the 2004 straight-to-DVD Wayans Brothers film, The Tale of Two Cities. Or C, the 1968 stage adaptation titled Two Cities, the Spectacular New Musical. A, B, or C?
Is it, which is the real one? Is that your question?
Is it true, the real one?
Yeah, true adaptation of the Dickens classic.
I think I might take B.
That would be
incorrect.
Wrong.
Okay.
But actually gets a second chance because you read the clue wrong, Marguerite.
I did?
Yeah, it's not a tale of two cities. It's a tale of two hoods
this
was
really
the thing. Okay, so the two choices for you, Bill Brett, are these. The 1996 Lifetime miniseries starring Kathy Bates and Albert Finney, or the 1968 stage adaptation titled Two Cities, the Spectacular New Musical, which would be the real adaptation, Bill Brett?
So it'd probably be C then.
That is correct. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's hear a little
I'm sorry, I'm goofing up all the questions today.
There's like trick
questions. Why don't you read the next one, Jim? Because I have no confidence.
That's right.
Okay, here's your question, Jim Botticelli. What's the last line of The Tale of Two Cities? I love these questions. A, a lifetime it took me to learn that it is better to be poor in pocket than impoverished in the heart and soul, if only I had been rich with wisdom early on. Or B, it is a far, far better thing I do than I've ever done before, a far, far better rest than I go to than I've ever known. Or C, whatever struggles and triumphs, however we may suffer them, all too soon they bleed into a wash, just like watery ink on paper. I think all three are great endings to some book,
That was the best of questions and the worst of questions.
Thank you very much. That's beautiful.
We're all good.
Give him an extra point.
The worst because I don't know the answer. Yeah.
Well, guess then.
Okay. Repeat them? No.
No.
Don't repeat them. Maybe a little tomorrow.
I'm going to go with A.
That is wrong. Now, is it either B, which begins, it is a far, far better thing, Bill Brett, or C, whatever our struggles and triumphs, et cetera. Which is it?
Probably C.
That would be incorrect. Marjorie, there's one left. Do you want to guess what it is or not, Marjorie?
It's a far, far better thing, you mean?
Thank you. Yes, you got it right.
Okay, that is correct.
Thank you. Marjorie gets a point.
Do we have time for one more? You do it.
Okay, fine. Why am I doing it?
Because I'm going to goof it up again.
No, you're not going to.
I've lost my confidence.
I have so much confidence.
Why don't we get you? Why don't we ask you?
Actually, Marjorie can participate in this, too. We've never done this before.
Okay.
Here's a question for you, Marjorie. In fact, Jim Botticelli, why don't you read, Marjorie, the question, a variation on a theme. It's that one right there. Good.
Okay. I'm going to ask you some Charles Dickens trivia.
Okay.
Which among these three things is true? The phrase, cute as the Dickens, derives from the waifs and street urchins common on Dickens' books. B, Charles Dickens' last words were on the ground. C, Public Enemy's hip-hop artist Carlton Ridenhour is better known by his stage name Chuck D. He chose Chuck D as an homage to Charles Dickens because, quote, he stood up for the poor and oppressed just like us.
Fabulous reading.
Yeah, she can tell. That was an excellent reading.
Go ahead. You an English teacher?
I used to be. Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I was on the radio once, too. Yeah.
You were. Don't stall, Marjorie.
Right. B.
Answer? B.
Very good, Marjorie. Now, in this theme, well, let's continue this theme. Yeah, this is the final question.
How about if I ask you a question? Yeah,
you ask me, right?
I'll ask you the question.
Jim knows everything.
What town, since we started to ask the question about
this is out of control,
the governor that he allegedly got drunk that night after the bomb and the suspect was arrested, what town did he get drunk in?
Well, I know where his manse is. He doesn't like it called a mansion.
How about the estate?
The estate is in Richmond. Mm-hmm. But is that, I don't know, is that where the restaurant is?
Great Barrington.
Give me the points anyway. Come on, Jim Brett.
That was good. That was good. That was good. You were close.
Now read me the Dickens question. I'll see how I do here. Go ahead. What is it?
The Tales this is of Bill the Brett cities, asking the women me a question. St. Antonian did what as they watched prisoners being executed?
Go ahead.
Damn socks.
Darn kit. Socks. I'm not sorry. Damn socks.
I don't have my glasses.
Thank you.
Me,
go ahead.
Kit. Knit.
Knit.
And needlepoint.
Oh, my goodness. You know the answer?
I
well,
do.
Then, Marjorie, I'll do a lifeline. You can do it,
well,
Marjorie.
I think it was knitting.
I'd say it was needlepoint. What's the answer?
Both of you are wrong.
Is that true?
It was darning socks.
No, both of you.
Oh,
shit.
Madame Defarge, she wasn't knitting?
Nope.
It
oh,
is
well.
A far, far better thing she did,
oh, yeah,
actually.
It was knitting. It was B. You were right.
Oh,
it
okay. was B. Yeah, okay. B,
well, right. thank you. Now, yeah. it turns out Marjorie's tied for a second.
Marjorie, did you not type all these questions out?
Now, Bill Brett, before we leave today, how do people find your work, other than going to Boston.com and in the Globe itself, you have a series of great books about Bostonians. How do people find all that stuff?
You can find it on Amazon.com. You can find it at Barnes & Noble, if there's any of them left. Major bookstores have them all.
And if I were to ask you who the most unpleasant celebrity in Boston is to take a picture of, would you answer my question?
Mm, boy, uncelebrity. Well,
who is like the most, who he or she wants their picture taken, but they complain about, oh, come on, Bill, let's move it here. I got,
well, this,
come on, give us their initials.
I don't want
backwards.
Them, you know, I don't want to out them. I mean, there are several people that,
what profession are they in?
Sports.
Really?
Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
I would bet sports ownership is
what
I would bet.
I think Bill should do a
sports ownership is actually pretty good.
They are good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
A book
yeah.
on legendary talk show hosts.
I know.
Don't you think?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, I could do that.
We wouldn't make the cut. That's the problem.
Make the cut.
You have to be a legend first.
Oh,
right?
Jim.
Thank you.
You're still on the air.
Exactly.
You're still on.
Jim, but I got to say something. What? My next book, which I'm halfway through, you will not be in it.
Oh, thank you. What is it?
Boston Irish.
Oh, that's probably true.
But Marjorie, you got a shot at it.
This could be my chance.
This could be my chance.
Okay, Jim Botticelli, how do we find this Facebook page that is becoming quite the rage?
Okay, the Facebook page is found simply by typing in Dirty Old Boston and liking it and getting all the pictures sent to your feed. And if you were interested in submitting a photo for the book, which we are working on right now.
A book on the same theme you're doing?
Yes, Dirty
oh, really?
Old Boston, the book. The book, yes. Please submit the photo to dirtyoldbostonproject.com. Visit that website and it'll tell you everything to do.
When you were teaching for all, you said 30 plus years in the public school system.
30.
Were you doing photography on the side and then all of a sudden you decided in retirement this was to be your thing or what?
No.
Meaning you just started as a retiree?
I just started. I didn't take all these pictures. I want to be clear about that. This is.
Collecting them. I know you're a connoisseur.
You call that kind
pictures.
Of book when you solicit photos. Using
compilation. Editor. Compilation.
There's a word.
Curator. Thank
curator.
You.
Curator.
Call it a curator.
That's
whatever it is.
Word, curator.
So it turns out we just found out Bill Brett hasn't taken all those photos either. That's really.
No, he has.
No, we
and
know.
And his daughter. His daughter is a great photographer, too.
Crowdsourced. Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, she's terrific.
But you have a good shot at this
Boston
book.
Irish. God, there's been seven books. I haven't made one
Can
yet.
I tell you?
Maybe this is my chance.
I don't want to put any pressure on anybody here, either Bill or Marjorie. But if Marjorie doesn't make it into Boston Irish, then, is there left?
Look at these freckles.
Let me say this.
Yeah.
You will make it.
Oh, good.
Great.
Thank you very much, Bill.
You deserve it.
The eighth book I was just told, Boston Jews. So there we are.
Well, let me just tell you, that's very true.
Is that true?
Nat Hentoff. Boston boy.
I had lunch with Bob Kraft and Jack Connors at the Erie Pub a few months ago. And Jack Connors is a big supporter of mine for this book. And Bob Kraft said to me, well, what about the Jews? I said,
and
you're next.
I love that. Yeah.
There you
By
go,
the way,
Jim.
Jack Connors is one of the great Bostonians.
He is one of the great Bostonians. I love him.
In any case, thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Gentlemen, it was great. Thanks to have you on the quiz.
Thank you.
The folks who work on the show, we don't thank these people enough. Our team is spectacular. Edgar B. Herwick III, Chelsea Mers, John Parker.
Will Roseclip, and Abby Ruzicka.
That is exactly right. You can follow
us.
I said his
name wrong.
You did, actually, but you'll have next week to try to get it right.
Sorry. Mm.
And what is my name, Marjorie?
Your name is Jim Broody.
Thank you. Follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio or at Jim Browdy or at Marjorie Egan. Have a wonderful weekend. We will see you on Monday. Thanks so much for being here.